Thank you for joining us for Life and Taxes with tax attorney Andrew Foster of Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. Call in now with your tax questions at 800-818-2255 or locally at 247-7282 or 353-4674.
And welcome to Life and Taxes with Andrew Foster from Harvell & Collins. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
Well, Ben, as we know, filing season has now come to a close.
Yeah.
Of course, there is those that got their extensions on time, which is great. You still have until October to get those taxes filed. But this is my kind of yearly talk about make sure that if you didn't file, you didn't get that extension, go ahead and get your taxes filed as quickly as possible. You know, one of the big things, Ben, is that the failure to file penalty is a percentage, and it's 5% per month or part of a month that a return is late. And so if you hear
that's big.
Yeah, exactly. So and just remember that's 5% of whatever the tax bill that's owed. But right now, you know, you're on the clock, so to speak. And if you can get your taxes filed during this month, during April into before May 15th, you know, you're looking at your maximum penalty for failure to file being 5%. And so that's a really, really big, you know, really big incentive because the next month that you hit, the next part of the month, well, guess what? It goes up another 5%.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're up to 10%. And so you continue on this 5% all the way up until 25% of the tax bill that you owe.
Wow.
So, you know, it's
very punitive.
It is. It's very punitive. And I know, you know, one of the big things we get out there is a lot of people saying, well, you know, I can't afford to pay the underlying tax bill that's associated with my return, so I'm just not going to file. You know, and the failure to pay penalty is a lot less punitive than the failure to file penalty. The failure to pay penalty is 0.5% for each month or part of a month that you go without paying. So, you know, the big thing here is that file, you know, and I know we talk about that a lot of times where filing solves a lot of your problems, you know, and your concern is, well, Andrew, you know, I owe this underlying tax bill. I know I've put it in a TurboTax or I've seen a CPA. He's told me what I owe. I can't afford to pay. Get it filed. Eliminate that failure to file penalty. Stop it right now at the 5% level, you know, and then payment options. There's payment options that are out there for individuals who owe a tax debt but can't afford to pay the underlying amount. I mean, you know, we talk about it. The IRS accepts, you know, credit cards, number one. Now, is that a great idea? It's not the best idea in the world, but I'll tell you what, if you know you can work on paying down that credit card debt
over a longer period, maybe.
Exactly, over a little bit of time, you know, it may make some sense for you to use a credit card potentially to pay your underlying tax.
Now, if you work out a payment plan, though, directly with the IRS, how does that compare?
That's correct. Yeah, so there's an installment agreement. That's the next thing that's on the list, which is, you know, if you owe $50,000 or less, Ben, you're looking at being able to do this online. You know, you go online, you check some boxes, and you can get a payment plan. You know, they want you to pay the full balance within 60 months
that's 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years. So you got 5 years to try to pay it in full. You know, if you owe less than $50,000, hopefully you can come up with a sum that you can meet. So just, you know, be aware that this is an option that's out there, which is to go online and simply get an installment agreement. There is a small user fee depending on whether you go direct debit or whether you want to pay with the check.
Always is.
But, you know, just be aware that's an option that's out there, and it's not because it costs that much money to do that.
All right. We have a caller with a question. Helen in Newport. Hi, Helen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing okay. What's your question for us today?
Question is about a K-1 and an individual partner. Actually, I'm asking for my family member whose wife is an individual partner in Georgia and was an LLC in Georgia. Sorry, I'm trying to keep it brief, but it's not possible. Anyway, they were told that the K-1 is not always subject to any earnings on the K-1 is not always subject to earned income. Looking over that, it seems to me that it would be earned income.
Yeah. It is. It's just the opposite of that. Yeah.
That's right. The K-1 basically what that means is that's the pass through income and expenses that are attributable to each member depending on the percentage that the member owns in the actual entity. So the LLC itself. So that gives them their tax attributes for that particular, business. And then, later on, you can't then go back and deduct expenses or anything else that's associated with it because the business itself should have been the one that would have done that. And so it should be all reflected on that K-1.
Right. Well, he was trying to reduce his income, last year, obviously, like we all are, but, was trying to see about putting any of it into a 401k or IRA or something along those lines. And, like I said, what we were reading up on, there was adjusted basis and all this other kind of stuff. So it was a little bit confusing. I wasn't quite sure because the CPA in Georgia said, oh, no, it's not subject to earned income. And we thought that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, getting into the weeds on it, the exact attributes. The K-1 gives you your tax attributes for that particular business. And then you're right. If you want to reduce your income, there's a way to put some money into potentially an IRA, for instance, to get that reduction in your taxable income.
Would that be the business that establishes a 401k, for example?
Not necessarily. No, okay. You can establish your own one on your IRA level. So, there are some options to be able to try to reduce your income level. Certainly Helen, if you want to give me a call or email me or whatever, I can kind of let you know some of the ways that can be done. But general rule, without getting into the weeds, that K-1 does give you what your tax attributes are for that particular business. And, I would say that gives you what your income should be as far as that entity goes. And then there's other things that you can do to try to lower your tax burden. There's things that businesses could do. Now, I don't know if he's a manager of the LLC or if he's, one
no,
of the things
just
that yells.
Individual
yells,
partner.
What's that?
Just an individual partner.
Is he
no manager, kind of like a
limited partner or something like that?
Yeah.
Like where he doesn't really have any ongoing action with the business.
Right.
Yeah. So, one of the things that the managers can be encouraged to do is to lower everyone's income. There's ways that the business can spend money, for instance, that's going to result in deductions that will lessen the amount of income that everyone receives. So if that's something that's, the downside is you don't get the income. The bright side is that you don't have to include it in income, and maybe the business can grow by spending that type of money. So that's something that, certainly he can encourage. But once you get that K-1 in your hand, it's tough to knock those numbers down because that's the business has already done that, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. He requested to have a 401k opened up.
Yeah.
Or something like that, but was told it was not possible. So, not sure. But anyway, yeah, I'll have him give you a call. That would be great.
Give me a call.
Thank you so much.
We'll get more into the weeds in a call and we'll see what we can do for you.
Thank you, Helen.
Perfect. Thanks. Okay.
There you go. And that's one of those complications about how you set up a business.
That's right. Yeah.
But still, you got to get it filed.
That's right. And we talked about these broad terms like earned income and, deductions and K-1s and things like that. And, what we do is we just try to look at what that means on a broad level, Ben, during the show and let people know. If you get that K-1, what you're responsible for is inputting those numbers that are on that K-1 onto your return. That's what you're responsible for. And then, what we can do to try to lessen the amount that's owed can either be done at the business level, meaning that you encourage the managers or whoever's managing the business to spend money in a certain way. Maybe she was mentioned setting up a 401k or some type of retirement plan.
Yeah.
Or you do it yourself on the back end, potentially setting up your IRA to put some money in there to lessen the amount of tax that you
have. A lot of times a new business might set up with a K-1 so that losses are passed through.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah. And the same thing. If there's losses for the business, they get passed out just as well as income does. So, that K-1 is literally just whatever your amount that's determined that you're the percentage ownership, it's going to give you your earnings, or it's going to give you your losses, or it's going to give you whatever it is for that particular tax year.
Right.
So that's the way that the K-1 works. Because remember, when we talk about a K-1, we're talking about the fact that the entity itself, that LLC that she mentioned, is not taxed at the entity level. It's only taxed by passing out the income to the partners or members.
Right.
So that's what you're looking at, and that's why those numbers, when you get them, are fairly fixed.
And then it becomes subject to your individual tax rate.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Subject to your individual tax rate. No corporate tax rate. You know, not a C corp where you have double taxation, where the entity's taxed at the entity level, then you pass out dividends, and then you're taxed again at the individual level. That's not the way that works for LLCs, for partnerships. It's literally just a tax at the individual level, and your K-1 tells you this is what you got to pay on.
That's it.
So that's the way that works. So kind of getting back to where we were talking about how we encourage everyone to file, go ahead and, you know, get in some type of arrangement with the IRS. We don't want you lingering out there with a tax bill where they're threatening levy or threatening, you know, some type of lien action against you. So certainly, you know, if you find yourself in that situation, it's always a good time to, you know, give me a call, shoot me an email, let me know, hey, Andrew, I owe some money to the IRS. What's the best way to handle this type of situation? We can go over your different options, but you know, we left off with the installment agreement, you know, and then we'll go into some other ones at a later date about other options that are available, such as offer and compromise and currently non-collectible status. But I really wanted to hit on this, Ben, since we just finished up with Masters Week. We had the 83rd edition of the Masters. You know, maybe one of the greatest comeback in sports with old Tiger Woods winning.
Sure.
But you know, the good thing about this is that our listeners can take advantage of a tax law, you know, whose history dates back to 1970s and actually deals with Augusta residents. You know, we've got 280A, which is the section that deals with the tax treatment of residential property. And the general rule on your primary residence is that you don't have to impute rent from owning a primary residence. And you also, your expenses aren't deductible except for your mortgage interest and your property taxes. So that's kind of your rule for your primary residence. On your rental real estate, the general rule is you include all of your rent that you receive, but you have free deductions. You deduct, you know, your actual expenses that you, insurance, you know, taxes, you know, if there's any maintenance or upkeep or repair regarding the property, you do that. But then there's this exception.
Yep.
And it's 280 Cap A Section G, which says if your dwelling unit is rented less than 15 days during the taxable year, then rental income shall not be included in gross income. I'll repeat, shall not be included in gross income. What this means, Ben, is if you rent your property for less than 14 days or less in a year, then you can take tax-free any rent that you receive. So this is great for our community because, you know, you may be sitting out there with a rental place that you don't rent really. You use it as a second residence.
You got Big Rock coming up.
You got, you know, various people wanting a vacation this summer. As long as you say, well, look, I don't really want to rent my place out. Well, I encourage you. Maybe rent it for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
Because if you rent it for 2 weeks, 14 days, you get tax-free money.
That's right. You can be spending your time in somewhere else.
That's right.
Enjoy the extra income that comes in. And just remember that when you come up on something like this. It's Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. We'll have more to come in a moment.